Now, hello, everybody. My name is Yann Meunier. I'm the moderator of this podcast, which is entitled 1HLGH, which stands for 1 Hour of Global Health. Our guest today is Dr. Michael Zema. But before I introduce him, I would like to put this into perspective. This podcast is part of a series. We had the first one on May 4th, and it was with Dr. Alain Fimat. And the theme was, what is wrong with global health in 2022? What are the solutions? This next one will be on July 8th, and it will be with Professor Joaquim Capalanga, and the theme will be global health from an African perspective. So, Dr. Michael Zema, Jay Zema, has enjoyed a tenure of 40 plus years in the healthcare arena on the inside as physician trainee, private practitioner, member of a hospital medical board, vice president of a physician independent practice association, board member of a physician holding company. He also worked in the pharmaceutical industry and as a malpractice legal consultant. He was also chief of cardiology at both community hospital and academics medical center. He was a professor of medicine at two state university colleges of medicine and physician clinical reviewer for a large national radiology benefits manager. Therefore, having operated in all of these above silos at one time or another, unlike so many other today so-called pundits, Dr. Zema has indeed walked the walk and not merely talked the talk. As such, he's uniquely qualified to debate healthcare delivery system in the US, providing a glimpse from the inside out. So Dr. Zema, please, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Jan. Thank you very, very much. And before we start, I'd like to mention that there are two types of individuals in this world. I call them lumpers and splitters. Lumpers are people who like to find, you know, one statement of commonality which explains all. Splitters, of which I must confess I am one, splitters are always looking for the detail that separate and allow us to define the nuances that separate items. Healthcare, until you get into the granular level of the data on healthcare and its delivery, you really can't appreciate the differences that occur among countries and the fine nuances that are present within each individual country. So in putting together the presentation here, I want to acknowledge that I've gone to multiple data sources, which include, among others, the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the World Index of Healthcare Innovation, the Kaiser Family Foundation, the Schaefer Center for Health Policy, the Brookings Institute, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services here in the US, the Commonwealth Fund, the US Census Bureau, the American Hospital Association, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, particularly the Office of the Inspector General, the Association of American Medical Colleges, 3M and the RAND Corporation, and the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. And I'm sure I've left out a few, and I'm hoping by acknowledging their contribution here that I won't have to, when I present each individual data fact, continue to acknowledge that indeed this data was culled from what I believe to be the most reputable sources that I can find in the U.S. Literature.
Okay, I think this is very useful. This information is very useful to and give some context to what you're about to say. And of course, I forgot to mention the theme of your intervention today, which is healthcare systems and global health, the US example. You will talk about the US example, and people that the listener, wherever they may be in Europe or Africa or Asia, they can compare this to their own healthcare systems and draw some conclusions. So, Dr. Zema, my first question is, would you please give us a short description of the US healthcare system?
Well, that would take about the hour right there. But,
I know. Sure.
Yeah, I know, but US healthcare system, Jan, has evolved over about 90 years. Prior to 1925-30, Americans paid for their healthcare nearly 100% out of pocket. And then the Blue Cross Blue Shield began in the early 30s. And of course, with the coming of the Second World War and our entry into that, and government wage and price controls on most of the industries because of runaway inflation, employers, in order to attract workers, started to offer healthcare benefits, particularly since those benefits were deemed to be non-taxable, both on the part of the employer and the employee. And indeed, that quote-unquote loophole in our taxation system has stood the test of time and is still in place. That is, payments toward premiums for healthcare are tax deductible. And so that was a way that employers during the 40s could attract workers, even though they couldn't increase their salaries because of governmental imposed wage and price controls. So that takes us into about, you know, into the 50s and 60s. The war ends now. Inflation gets under a little better control. But a significant number of the population is now insured through their employer. And I'm just guessing about 1960, 1965, I would say about 70% of Americans under age 65, in other words, working Americans, were receiving employer-sponsored health care insurance. There was some momentum. In 1949, President Harry Truman said, you know, there's a lot of people that are retired and they don't have health care insurance. Their employer certainly doesn't want to cover them because these are the sicker individuals in our population. So President Truman, in his first term, tried to introduce single payer into the U.S. Well, to quote Newsweek magazine at the time, quote, no chance at all, unquote. And indeed, it died in committee. I don't think it ever even passed one house of Congress. But the problem persisted. Truman tried again in 1952 to pass single payer for those individuals over 65. He was trying to cover this large segment of the population that was ill and was still, to a large part, paying out of pocket. Unfortunately, he once again failed, but 13 years later, President Lyndon Baines Johnson was able, through the Social Security Act, to pass Medicare, Title 18 of the Social Security Act, and Medicaid, Title 19, insuring the population over age 65 with Medicare and the indigent population with Medicaid. And that launched the public sector into healthcare in the United States. And that sector has grown dramatically since that time. Currently in the US, about 160 million or so individuals are insured through an employer plan, with about 20% or so of that expense, the premium, borne by the employee, and about 80% borne by the employer. The remainder of individuals in our country, traditional Medicare, which covers individuals over 65, those on Social Security disability, and those in chronic renal failure on dialysis. That accounts for about 38 million individuals in our country. Medicare Advantage, which was initially labeled as Medicare Plus Choice in 1965, and the name later changed to Medicare Advantage in the early 70s, which basically is the involvement of private insurance companies accepting a capitated bundle of monies to take care of individuals that are over age 65. So in other words, individuals like myself, we can stay with the traditional government Medicare, which is a fee-for-service type of payment, or we can elect to have a private health insurance company manage our medical affairs, and therefore we would sign up with a Medicare Advantage plan. That's another 26 million individuals and is growing rapidly. In the last decade, there has been a significant shift of individuals from traditional government Medicare into the privatized Medicare arena of Medicare Advantage. I also mentioned that in 1965, with the Social Security Act, Medicaid was born. That has continued to grow at the fastest rate of all of American healthcare insurance. Currently, there are 80 million Americans that are insured through Medicaid, 33 million of which are children under age 19 years. And then, of course, we have the CHIP program, which is separate from the children in Medicaid. This is the Child Health Insurance Program. And the difference between CHIP and the children in Medicaid is CHIP does allow children whose families are at slightly higher incomes to obtain insurance for their children, even if they themselves as adults are not eligible for Medicaid as a family. So we have another 7 million children less than 19 years of age that are in the CHIP program. Now, I throw out all these numbers, Jan, because it's interesting. If you add them all up, yeah, and those are all numbers from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid or the Kaiser Family Foundation. I left out the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Yeah. 15 million are also insured there through the marketplace. But if you add up 156, 15, and 38, and 26, and 80 and 7, you get 322 million. Now, that's interesting because our latest U.S. Census, 2021, says that we have 332 million people in this country. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I don't have to be a mathematics boffin here to say 332 minus 322 only leaves 10 million people in this country, which is 3% of our population without health care insurance. Yet that is not at all clear. For instance, the National Health Interview Survey, NHIS, which utilized basically a computer-assisted personal interview technique looking at 35,000 households in America, came up with the fact that 10% of Americans are without health insurance of any kind. Now, 3% and 10%, those may look like little differences, but we're talking about millions of people here. We're talking about 10 million people versus 20 to 30 million people. So I'm not sure, and I'm embarrassed to say that, but I'm not sure actually how many people in the United States are currently without health insurance. What I can tell you is that we do have data that if you're not a citizen, you're three times more likely to have health insurance if you're a green card holder, let's say, but you're a legal immigrant, and you're probably 5 to 10 times more likely to not have health care insurance if you're an illegal immigrant. That data, again, is difficult to come by, as you can imagine, but that seems fairly clear. So among those that are legal, and certainly among those that are citizens, it is not a large segment of our population that is currently in 2022 without health care insurance of any kind. So there's a nutshell. And remember, in the private marketplace, Jan, we have 880 different insurance firms with over 6,000 separate insurance establishments connected with those firms. So you can imagine the negotiations that go on between provider networks, hospitals, and the private insurance industry. And you can imagine how this has led to an impetus for us as a country to look at single payer or the public option, as they've been speaking about recently, as a simplification for this gobbledygook, which exists due to this 90-year buildup, if you will, 90-year evolution of healthcare in the United States.
And that leads to my second question, because those are the quantitative data. What is the result of this complexity on the quality of healthcare that is provided?
Well, we spend a lot of money in this country. Mm-hmm. So healthcare expenditure as a percentage of GDP or per capita, and that's per capita adjusted for differences in the cost of living, or might be termed purchasing power parity, U.S. ranks number one in the world. Number one. Pre-COVID, we spent $3.6 trillion. During the COVID pandemic, due to the health declared emergency, we spent $4.1 trillion on healthcare. So we're certainly ranked number one in dollars spent. And the next highest country, which I believe is Switzerland, has spent more than one third less than us. And we are double in spending that of the 38 country average reported by the OECD. Now, despite spending all that money, I'm embarrassed to say the U.S. ranks 29th out of 38 in the OECD in overall life expectancy. The countries that are ranked lower than us are the three Baltic nations, Poland, Hungary, the Slovak Republic, Turkey, Mexico, and Colombia. Really, Jan, I mean, I'm embarrassed.
Well, and also, this is also focused on curative medicine. What about the private preventive side? And what about also the public health side?
Right. Well, you know, in regard to quality, because that's what you alluded to.
Yeah.
You know, in acute care, if you look at some of the outcome measures, we do pretty well. The USA, our 30-day acute mortality for an MI is 5%. We're ranked 9th out of 28 countries that report it. Our 30-day stroke mortality, at 4%, we're ranked 4th out of 26 countries that do report it. For chronic care, and I'm using cancer as chronic care because at least with cancer, we can get the longitudinal follow-up that's necessary. We're ranked number one in the world in breast cancer survival, 5 years from the time of diagnosis, first of 34 countries. Colon cancer, we're tied for 9th. Lung cancer, we're ranked 6th of 34 countries. So on those measures of quality of care, we're doing pretty well. And I think I can safely say that we rank in the top quarter of countries overall in regard to quality of care outcome measures. Now, process of care measures, because we significantly lack primary care physicians in this country, we probably fall down significantly. I mean, most countries, if you look at their balance between primary care providers and specialty physicians, most countries are about 70-30, 70% primary care and 30% specialty. In the U.S., flip that upside down. We're about 30-35% primary care physicians and 70% specialists. So if you start to look at processes of care, did my patient get a blood pressure check in the last 6 months? Have they had their lipid panel checked? Are they getting their appropriate pneumococcal vaccines? How about their flu vaccines, et cetera? Things that are routinely handled by primary care, they can easily fall through the cracks because those primary care physicians are just not available. In fact, because of this, mid-levels have grown dramatically in the U.S. And I think for the first time in 2021, mid-levels, that includes nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, now outnumber the number of primary care physicians in the United States. There are about 310,000 MDs and DOs, doctors of osteopathy, in the U.S., and that's data from the Association of American Medical Colleges. And there are 306,000 nurse practitioners who practice primary care and 35,000 PAs who practice primary care. And if you add those up, that means we've got 341,000 mid-levels doing primary care versus 310,000 physicians doing primary care. And that's only going to get greater. How do I know that? Take a look at the training schools and academies. We are increasing the number of primary care physicians in the U.S. by 0.5% per year. On the other hand, nurse practitioners are growing at 6-9% per year. And indeed, NPs grew at 9% last year, even in the setting of the COVID pandemic. PAs are growing at 3-6% per year. So those curves of primary care physicians versus mid-levels doing primary care are going to separate even further as these trainees graduate and enter the healthcare provider arena.
Yes, yes. And and I think that nurses and PAs are entitled to immunize people. Yet the coverage for immunization is not that great. How do you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we are a republic. Although we're a democracy in the U.S., we are a republic of 50 states. And the scope of practice for mid-levels is really handled on a state-by-state basis. Mm-hmm. So currently, I believe 24 states, for instance, with nurse practitioners allow full gamut for the nurse practitioner to do just about anything that a physician provider does. But among the other 26, there are restrictions, including about 12, which still require that a physician oversee almost everything that they do. And vaccinations play into that role. So this is a fight that, you know, the NP and PA organizations wage on a yearly basis. And the good news is slowly the medical associations have to realize, because they're being forced into it, that they just don't have the manpower out there in primary care to do it. So they're going to have to allow more and more to be done by mid-levels, or the quality of care will definitely suffer in the country.
Okay, so yeah, because I think in California they're entitled to do that. You can get immunized at the CVS or Walgreens by a nurse. Given all the data and all the information that you just gave us, what are the upsides and the downsides of this complexity and this type of system? Huh? Hello.
Yeah, I'm trying to.
I know. Okay. Okay. I thought there was a technical problem.
I'm trying to formulate a coherent. Yeah. I'm trying to formulate a coherent answer to a question that I could probably talk about an hour on. Well, the upsides of it is we're number one in research in the world. Without us, you wouldn't have more than half of your new drugs. So that's an upside. No question about it. In the R&D arena, we spend far more than any other country in the world. In fact, we spend about 0.9% of our GDP on healthcare R&D. That's dramatically more than any other country in the world. In novel drug approvals, Juan, we had 48 in the year 2019. That's four times the next country, which was Switzerland. And it's 60% of the new drug approvals worldwide. So you want your medicine? You need the U.S., unless things dramatically change. We were first in Nobel Prize in medicine and in chemistry per capita, adjusted for population. So that's an upside. How do we fund all this healthcare R&D? 67% from industry, 22% from federal agencies, academia, about 8%, foundations, state and local governments, professional societies, about 3%. But there's no doubt Americans pay the tab for the rest of the world in that regard. Downsides? Yeah, go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
Yeah. What about technology? I thought it's a big upside, no?
Yeah, technology, you know, I look at technology as how do we utilize it and what are we working on? Well, for tech utilization, I start to look at, again, the OECD data. You know, we're ranked fourth out of 38 in CT scanners per population. Of course, because of the practice of defensive medicine, which I could talk about when we talk about the downside that you asked about, we're ranked number one in CT scans per population, per capita. So we do more, even though we're only fourth in the number of scanners, we're first in how many scans you get done. At an average cost varying between 2 and 8 times what other countries charge for a CT exam. Again, MRI scanners, we're again ranked fourth in scanners per population, but we're ranked second per capita in the number of scans done. Again, I'll get back to defensive medicine a little bit later. We're ranked number one in mammography equipment that's out there. And why? Why all these? Well, remember, 70% of our physicians are specialists. I'm trying to think, who was it who said, I think it was to a man with a hammer, a lot of things look like nails that need pounding.
Yes.
You know, yes. If you've got the hammer, then you're looking for nails.
That's right.
So, you know, we've got the equipment, so things get done. But again, technology is part of that healthcare R&D, and we have brought many, many, many new innovations to the rest of the world, but at a price that Americans are paying for. Now, you asked about the downside. Okay, the downside is the price that the Americans are paying. We pay far more for our pharmaceuticals than the rest of the world. Has an expenditure for pharmaceuticals and other medical non-durables per capita, we're ranked number one in the world. Germany's ranked number two, and there they spend 50% on pharmaceuticals compared to Americans, and they're ranked number two. On average, we're about three times the other 37 countries that report in the OECD. And that's even though 80% of our drugs Jan are generic right now, but our brand names are so damn expensive compared to what you pay overseas that it more than makes up for the generics that are on our various formularies. So the price per dose in the US is more than two times what Europeans pay, even after adjusting for purchasing power parity.
And how, I mean, but how is the share of the market? Well, first of all, can people buy drugs online from other countries, in particular Canada?
They can now. Former President Donald Trump tried to make some headway there. And while I don't have direct knowledge of that, I believe they can now in certain circumstances and from certain other countries. But again, right now, the U.S. consumer accounts for 70% of the total pharmaceutical profits in this world, despite accounting for only 27% of the global income of pharmaceutical companies throughout the world. So obviously the margin of profit is far higher here in the U.S. than what you're seeing on the other side.
And tied to this, I don't know if you can expand on this, on the pharmaceutical lobby in Washington to try to change this.
Yeah, well, I think the pharmaceutical lobby in Washington is probably second only to the tort malpractice attorney lobby that's in Washington, D.C. And that's why our tort reform can never get done in Congress, because Congress, unfortunately, to a large extent, I'm afraid, has been bought by the pharmaceutical lobby and the malpractice attorney lobby. Very strong lobbies with lots and lots of resources from all those profits that I just alluded to earlier.
Yeah. Okay, that's one source of the problem. Now, can you please give us your take on defensive medicine? Because this is a very, very, to me, it seems like a huge part in the cost of healthcare here. The fact that you mentioned, for example, the CAT scan, the fact that now almost when you go to a doctor, almost they request a CAT scan for whatever you have. Used to be X-ray, but now the first exam that is requested is CAT scan. And also the second aspect is because people are afraid of malpractice, lawsuit, and so on, they tend to ask a battery of tests to make sure that they don't leave anything out, which many of them are. This is one way of practicing medicine, but in other countries they go for what's the most usual, and then if the patient doesn't respond to the medication or the diagnosis is another one, then they try something else. You see what I mean? So, and since you you go by statistics, you say, okay, with 90% of the chance that this is this diagnosis, well, 90% of the patient, this is over, and you have a limited number of tests.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, Jan. I talk about it extensively in chapter 8 of my new book, Modern Healthcare Delivery, Deliverance or Debacle, A Glimpse from the Inside Out. In that chapter, I look at what are the main drivers of healthcare costs in this country. And certainly high up on the list is waste. Waste being overutilization or utilization of services that are of no value or at least low value in our healthcare system. And one of the drivers of overutilization, as you've alluded to, is the practice of defensive medicine. Now, you would think that we would have a lot of hard data on, how much does the practice of defensive medicine contribute to total healthcare expenditure in the U.S., but we really don't. Again, I'm embarrassed to say that we really do not. The estimates are from, you know, 2 to 5%, but the studies that they quote to come up with that estimate are extremely flawed. And in fact, Dr. Thomas Price, the 23rd Secretary of Health and Human Services under the Trump administration, personally estimates that the practice of defensive medicine could count for 1/4, 25% of total healthcare expenditures. That's $650 billion with a B dollars, young. And I've got to tell you, having worked for a large radiology benefits manager in charge of pre-authorization for high-level cardiac testing, that when I get these physicians on the telephone, we get a chance to air out all of our feelings. The number one reason why they are asking me for a high-level test is their fear of a misdiagnosis, their fear of a malpractice action. A malpractice action in this country on a young individual could cost you your ability to have a job in the future. When you apply, the first thing they do if you apply to work at a hospital or whatever is, please list your malpractice actions in the last 10 years and how they were settled. So this is not a trite matter for physicians to have to deal with. And you know, it all comes down to on how the human psyche deals with low risk, unlikely events. In healthcare, even though something may be low risk and unlikely, our brains aggrandize it, if you will. They expand on that. That's what they remember. And the very likely event, the converse, if you will, the very likely good outcome gets trivialized in your brain, particularly when dealing with very emotional subjects, such as an individual's life and healthcare. So until as a society, we are going to be willing to accept a miss rate, M-I-S-S, a miss rate, I don't think we're ever going to get a better handle on the practice of defensive medicine, at least in this country. Tort reform, as I said, the malpractice attorney lobby in Washington, D.C. is very strong, and most of these cases are all handled on a consignment basis, which means, you know, if you lose the case, you don't owe the attorney anything, but if you win, they take 30 to 40% off the top of your settlement. So therein lies that driver of waste or unnecessary use of services.
What about academia as a driver that leads to this kind of medical practice? I mean by that, you know, you learn, you practice what you learn.
Yes, yes. My wife, who's a school teacher, retired now, says children learn what they live, and you know that's the environment that they grow up with, both at home and in the classroom. I guess so. But you know, many of the academicians that I quote in my book actually realize that we have a problem, that we're putting far too much emphasis on the technology, as you alluded to. We're putting the cart before the horse. You know, we're trivializing the history and physical examination. We're not giving enough time to listen to the patient's complaints. Because each visit is pushed for time, and we're cramming more and more visits into the hour because the insurance company is paying less and less per visit, and the provider is trying to maintain income, whether that's a good or a bad thing, we could talk hours about. They're ordering the test because they're afraid that because they've laid short shrift to the first part, the cognitive part, we better do the test just to make sure that I don't miss a diagnosis and end up with a malpractice action.
Well, I can speak from experience that the PNH when I was a medical student, was the bulk of the consultation with the patient. And then you would go to the test and so on. Now, PNH is the small portion. And then what the big portion is the requesting the and putting every data on the computer.
Right. And again, you know, I talk about this in chapter, I believe it's chapter 3. I titled it, What the Heck Ever Happened to Marcus Welby, MD? But again, I remember the five fingers, right? The thumb was the history, the index finger was the physical examination, et cetera, et cetera. And laboratory was the little pinky, was the fifth finger that you used to confirm your clinical impression and to substantiate your differential diagnosis. No, it's backwards now. Okay, no. You go to the emergency room, emergency room physician doesn't even look at you. He draws a plethora of blood tests, puts you through the scanner or this and that, and then looks at it and says, let's see what's stuck. Let's throw all this spaghetti against the wall and let's see what sticks, and that'll be my diagnosis. It's all backwards.
Yes, they expect the test to give them the diagnosis. Well, the test should be the confirmation of that diagnosis, not the what leads you to the diagnosis. But anyway.
And of course, the test drives the cost, right? Yeah,
exactly.
The tests drive the cost.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about one topic that is been under the radar recently because of COVID. What about equity in healthcare? Not only in the patient side, but also on the provider side. Because as you know, if you look at the landscape in a hospital, some hospital, not all of them, but African-Americans and Latinos and so on, represent a minority. I mean, and it is not absolutely not proportional to their share of the population. So what have you investigated on this side?
Okay, well, you know, when we talk about equity, I like to start that discussion by talking about bias.
Yes.
You know, we have explicit and we have implicit and bias. And certainly implicit bias, does exist in medicine. Psychologists say that we all have bias. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's part of our human nature. I mean, examples of bias, which are probably unconscious, is, you know, female pilots are mistaken for flight attendants. Male nurses are often mistaken for doctors, and female doctors mistaken for nurses. Females in the construction industry generally are not presumed to be the contractors or the general managers. Okay, so, you know, implicit bias, unfortunately, is there. And we have to recognize it and do the best we can to not allow it, to grow to the point where it is discriminatory in our actions and in our lives. Now, having said that, what about implicit bias in medicine at the level, let's say, of the patient?
Yes.
Well, we have a couple of studies on that. The NORC, that's the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago, they asked patients, do you trust your provider? That was the word, I believe, that they used. And they looked at the various races. 86% of whites said they trusted their provider. 76% of African Americans, which I will call blacks for simplicity's sake at this point, said they trusted their provider. And 77% of Hispanics said they trusted their provider. Now, if you do some simple chi-squares there, you come up with a statistically significant difference between whites and either of the other two races, blacks and Hispanics. So whites seem to trust their provider more. We can talk about why, but that's the fact. Now, they also asked them a second question. As a patient, do you feel discriminated? Now that raises it to another level, John. Do you feel discriminated at the hands of your doctor? Mm-hmm. 21% of blacks said they felt discriminated. Only 11% of whites and Hispanics said they felt discriminated. And only 8% of Asians felt they were discriminated. Again, you do some chi-squares, and the Blacks sort out significantly greater than any of the other three major race categories. So something's going on here, and it looks like it's cultural, based upon a whole lot of family and socioeconomic interactions, but it's real. There appears to be some implicit bias in the patient's perception of healthcare. Now, we can take it to the next step, okay? Press Ganey, you're familiar with the Press Ganey surveys where they evaluate patients on their way out the door from the hospital. They looked at 117,000 patient encounters in 2020. 80% or so were white individuals, 13% were African Americans, 2% Hispanics, and 3% Asians. They looked at, did you score your encounter with your physician? Did you give it a 5 out of 5, a top score? They just looked at top scores. Well, who gave the highest amount of top scores? Whites. Next, African-Americans and Hispanics. Least highest scores, Asians. Asians gave the least highest scores, and they were significantly different than the others. Yet, if you look at how those Asians assessed their healthcare, and we did that in the CAHPS study, the Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers, which is a CMS study. If you looked at that, Asians scored their care the highest. So Asians are tough to please, okay? They don't give you 5 out of 5, but when you ask them, how is your healthcare, they score higher than any of the other races. So we have a disconnect between patients' subjective perception of their interaction with the physician and their objective assessment of, you know, I got better. I think he did a damn good job, or she did a damn good job taking care of me. So there's implicit bias here, and it's there on the part of the patient. It's also there on the part, if you will, of the patient's interaction with the race of the doctor. Again, that Press Ganey score, if you looked at the race of the physician and the race of the patient, whether there was concordance or discordance, again, now who got a 5 out of 5 rating? Well, in concordance with white patients, 88% got a 5 out of 5 rating if their physician was white. African Americans, 82% if their physician was Black. Hispanics and Asians, 81 and 72%. Now, interestingly, the Hispanic and Asians, they were not different, whether it was concordant or discordant. So Hispanics and Asians don't appear to be looking at the race of their provider when attempting to give an overall evaluation of their service in a recent hospitalization. Whites, on the other hand, and Blacks do give a higher rating when their provider has a concordant race with them. So again, this is implicit bias, that's present in all of us. So that's bias. And I know I didn't talk about equity yet, but I'm getting to that. But we need to have that background on bias before we can begin to fathom through equity.
Well, let me just inject this. There's also studies that show that the doctors spend less time with African-Americans than Caucasians, for example. So this is, and that, you know, maybe you can piggyback on this and go into the equity aspect.
Yeah, having practiced in areas where there are a significant percentage of minorities, I've not seen it. Okay. I would love to look at the methodology of those studies, and I'll have more to say about that in my final comments. So, but I will comment on two things with equity. We have two fantastic studies that have come out in the last few years. The first one was a study by 3M and the RAND Corporation. And they looked at people over 65. Remember, I mentioned those are the ones who have Medicare in the US. And these were people who had traditional government Medicare, not privatized Medicare Advantage, but traditional Medicare. So they all had insurance, John. They all had the same insurance. And they looked at the quality of care. They looked at 9 measures of performance: ED admissions, surgical mortality, ambulatory visits, potentially preventable hospital admissions, potentially preventable readmissions, et cetera. What did they find? They found that independent of race, beneficiaries in the lowest socioeconomic status, and they used the CDC's Social Vulnerability Index to calculate that, had higher than expected rates of all potentially preventable events and higher surgical mortality. They've got the same insurance product, Jan. Mm-hmm. Now, of note, white beneficiaries were only 20% more likely to be in the lowest quartile relative to the upper quartile in their socioeconomic status. And they were 5 times more likely, or less likely, rather, than Blacks and Hispanics to be in the lowest socioeconomic quartile. So what I'm saying is, it's your socioeconomic status to a large extent that will determine your outcome. So this big push, you know, America is not insured, we need to insure more. Well, these are people with the same insurance product. So it goes deeper than insurance. And again, the second study looked at Medicare Advantage patients. Again, they're over 65, okay? And when they looked at HEDIS measures of outcome, again, what they showed was Asian patients did the best. Asian patients did significantly better than whites, Hispanics, and African Americans. Okay, well, why? They've got the same Medicare Advantage product. So what I'm saying is the culture, the family, the upbringing, the importance that's been associated with good health care in that particular culture may be the primary determinant. And until we address those issues in this country and address them effectively, not just with affirmative action, we may find ourselves having insured the entire population, but not having really moved the needle in regard to equity in healthcare outcomes.
Yes, but I also think that those issues are correlated, and you cannot address one without addressing the other. So you see what I mean? The race of somebody is linked to the socioeconomic level, is linked to the place where they live, is linked to, and this form a whole.
Right, but Jan, what I'm saying is it's not your skin color. It's the things associated perhaps demographically, socioeconomically, that statistically may associate with that skin color, but it's not systemic racism.
Okay. We'll have to define also what systemic racism is. But anyway, what do you think would be the takeaways? Well, first of all, the solution. Is there a unique solution for all these problems? I mean, universal healthcare, would that be better? And the second, my ending would be on the takeaways. What do you think should we all remember of this of your presentation in terms of the U.S. healthcare system?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, again, things move slowly in the political world. You know, our Declaration of Independence guarantees life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. There's no mention of healthcare The Fifth Amendment to our Constitution states that no one shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The preamble to our Constitution states that the government is established to promote the general welfare. Where does the common defense and general welfare end and individual health care begin? Could Thomas Jefferson, one of our founding fathers, ever imagine that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness would include the inalienable rights? God bless Microsoft. Okay. Could Tom Jefferson, in his wildest dreams, have ever imagined, John, that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness would include the inalienable right of universal health care provided by the government? You know, universal health care would require a change in attitude and perspective. And we're starting to see that. I think it's generational. Surveys have shown that the young in our country are much more open to support universal health care and indeed even single payer than are the older individuals in our population. It's really an exercise, Jan, in moral persuasion, right? Because aren't the taxes that would by necessity have to be levied disproportionately upon wealthier Americans to deal with this issue? That's a much larger social income, a much larger social issue, rather, of income and wealth inequality. And until that becomes a serious public policy that we as a country are willing to deal with, it's not going to happen. But remember what I said. Truman tried in 1952 to basically establish Medicare. And Newsweek said, what? No chance at all. But 13 years later, Lyndon Baines Johnson passed Medicare. So again, things happen in our country when the public demands that they happen and they take it to the voting booth.
And the misconception about what they call socialized medicine. Because when you ask the US population, you know, what about Medicare? Well, don't touch Medicare. But that's what they call socialized medicine. So there's a problem here of information and also knowledge and education maybe of the population, I think.
You're absolutely right, Jan. If you ask the population a question and phrase it three different ways, you'll get three different answers.
Yeah.
Those kinds of studies have been done. You know, what do you think about, you know, Medicare for all? Medicare for all would mean that everybody has insurance and the government pays for it. Well, 100% of people, we want that. Well, but your taxes might double. No, we don't want that. So it depends upon how the question is phrased. And unfortunately, it is the responsibility of the media, which often include, as I mentioned earlier, the quote pundits, unquote, who don't have good information to give to the public so that they can make a rational, cogent decision when they're in the voting booth.
Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, what you just told us is that the problem is the use of resources and use of funding in the healthcare system. I mean, the money is available. It's just a problem how it's been used.
Right. Now, I know you asked me for a summary.
Yes.
But I'd like to finish, you know, with some personal thoughts.
Okay.
And some pithy but relevant remarks that others have made.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would tell people out there that in the digital world in which we now live, please don't surrender to the technological varlets, fax, email, text, electronic health records. The very effective and personable interactions that you have with your colleagues and patients, including, as you and I alluded to earlier, the carefully performed physical exam, which represents an important transactional moment between doctor and patient, this laying on of healing hands, that fosters, Jan, a trust that's needed for relational continuity and eventually effective cure of the patient. To those out there who would have us believe, Jan, that technology or artificial intelligence will replace that needed interaction, I would have them remember a Girl Scout adage in this country, which says, make new friends, but keep the old. The one is silver, the other gold. And remember, no one cares how much you know until they know how much you care. Healthcare is complicated. So therefore is its delivery, Jan. H.L. Mencken once said, for every complex problem, there is a solution, which is simple, direct, and wrong. So don't be taken in by pundits with their snippets and soundbites. Remember, an intellectual argument, including detailed statistical analysis, they can at first appear to be quite cogent, but upon critical reexamination, they may be fraught with erroneous assumptions and even faulty methodology. Albert Einstein once stated, not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything worth counting can be counted. Benjamin Disraeli, the 19th century Prime Minister of England twice over, was even more frank when he said, there are three kinds of lies, lies, damned lies, and statistics. Lastly, I would have your audience review multiple sources of information before drawing your own conclusions. As plain spokesman Benjamin Franklin, the 18th century scientist, inventor, and diplomat, is said to have once stated, believe half of what you read and none of what you hear. I hope at least what your audience has heard today from me will, however, be an exception to Ben Franklin's statement.
This is just wonderful, Dr. Zeman. Would you please give us a couple or two or three books that people can find online if they want to go deeper into what you said today?
Well, of course, I always push my own book, which yes, has very good reviews, which you can see on Amazon as well as Barnes & Noble. It's available digitally or in hardcover, also available through Apple Books and Google Play. That's Modern Healthcare Delivery, Deliverance or Debacle, A Glimpse from the Inside Out. It's about 360 pages with over 500 references, many of which are peer reviewed. It will be a good introduction for you. There's something in there for everyone, for providers at all levels, and even for patients to help them navigate through the complex healthcare system present in this country. Outside of that, I have to confess, Jan, most of the books that are out there are written at a level for healthcare administrators or high-level providers and are not where I would start my quest to understand this. And that was the impetus for me to spend 4 years researching and writing my book, was to try to fill that gap, if you will.
Thank you so much, Dr. Zeman, for this very enlightening and very eye-opening, for myself. I speak for myself, but I hope also for the listener, this presentation and this Q&A. I will now close it and close this off and give everybody, wish everybody a nice evening or morning or wherever you are, and hope that you will join us for the next podcast. It will be on July 8th, and you can find them also online with InVivox. Thank you very much, and goodbye.